Each year, the average American consumes about 150 pounds of sugar and artificial sweeteners, and it's one of the more widely used food ingredients in the world. But did you ever consider its importance to the history of the United States, as well as its connections to science and technology, labor, capital, politics, even popular culture? In this month's episode of the History Explorer podcast, we'll hear from Deborah Warner, a curator here at the museum whose recent book, Sweet Stuff, explores the role of sweeteners in American history.
My name is Debbie Warner. I'm a curator in the National Museum of American History. I'm responsible for some of the scientific instruments in our collections, things like telescopes and surveying instruments and things that you might find in your science classes. And in the past couple of years, I've been writing a history of sweeteners in the American past. And by sweeteners, I mean natural ones like sugar and honey, but also somewhat ones that we're familiar today, like corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup, and also artificial ones. Recently, all of this came out in a book called Sweet Stuff, which was published earlier this summer. Traditionally, sugar came from something called sugar cane. And sugar cane is a really tall grass that originated in the South Pacific a long time ago, about 9,000 years ago. And over time, people learned how to chew the grass and it tasted good. And then they learned how to grind it and extract the sweet sap of the juice. And eventually they learned how to boil this stuff down so you could get granulated sugar like we have in our sugar bowls at home. So I said sugar originated in the South Pacific, and it spread to China and India. It then spread to the Mediterranean world. And there wasn't any sugar in America until 1493, when Columbus, on his second voyage to the Americas, brought some sugar cane and had it planted in the Caribbean. Now, an important thing about sugar cane is that it doesn't grow everywhere. It mostly grows around the equator in the tropic lands. And so we'd love to have it grow here in Maryland or Virginia where we live, but it doesn't grow here. It grows really well in the Caribbean. When we read about the Europeans first coming to America, we often think of them looking for gold and silver and other precious things. But Columbus understood that sugar was really valuable. When he set out in 1492, Europeans knew about sugar, but it was so expensive that only rich people could eat it. Ordinary people never had any sugar in their lives. It just wasn't affordable. And probably they didn't have very much sweet stuff at all, except if they got maybe a piece of fruit or a little bit of honey. So Columbus understood that sugar was another sort of gold. It was really valuable. And other Europeans understood that too. So the Spanish and Portuguese established sugar plantations in South America. And finally, the British, the English, got into the act, and they set up a colony on Barbados. That's an island in the Caribbean. And when they realized how much work it was to grow and cut and process sugar cane, they imported African slaves for that purpose. And it was largely through sugar cane that African slaves came to the Americas. So the people in Barbados, the English people in Barbados, were so excited about growing sugar cane that they didn't want to use any of their time or land for other crops, which meant they had nothing to eat except sugar. And in the 1640s, the colonists who had come to Massachusetts were looking for a way to make money. Okay? And they figured out that they could grow wheat, they could raise chickens and cows and things like that. They had trees, so they had lumber, and they could send all this stuff to Barbados. And in exchange, they could get either sugar and rum for Barbados, or else money that they could use to spend in America or even in England. So a big part of the economy of Massachusetts and other colonies on the North American mainland was involved with the sugar business in Barbados and other Caribbean colonies. But there's another part of the story, and that's Africa. The people in England did not want to cut the cane. People in North America didn't want to cut the cane. And so colonists in Barbados, as I said, went looking for people who they could force to cut the cane. And this was slaves from Africa. And maybe you've heard of the triangle trade. Well, the triangle trade is involved in this, but it was a little more complicated than that. It began when people from England and France, other European countries, went to Africa and took gold and guns and brandy to buy slaves, which they would then take to the colonies in the Caribbean. But after a while, the Europeans and the Americans figured out that brandy was a French product, and the English did not want to trade with the French, but they had figured out to take the sugar cane juice and turn it into rum, a nice tasting, sweet alcoholic beverage, and that they could use rum to purchase slaves in Africa. So the triangle trade, what we call the triangle trade, was a matter of taking sugar and rum from the Caribbean to either New England or to London, and then taking some of that rum and some money to Africa to buy slaves, and then taking the slaves to the Caribbean. On a sugar plantation, on the one hand, you grow the sugar cane, but you have to then squeeze the juice out of the cane real quickly. Otherwise, it'll turn into starch and it isn't sweet or good to taste at all. So on the sugar plantations, people built sugar mills, which were big grinding equipment that would squeeze the juice out of the cane. And then they boiled it down and got crystallized sugar. But the stuff that was left over was still sweet, but not quite as sweet as the real sugar. The real sugar you could put in a barrel and ship off to New York or London or Massachusetts. The stuff that was left over was called molasses. And you could do two things with molasses. You could either eat it like a syrup, like you would put on your pancakes, or you could ferment it and turn it into rum. Even in the colonial period, even after the British established their colonies in Barbados, sugar was still really expensive and molasses was really cheap. So again, only the rich people could eat sugar, but molasses was something that poor people ate a lot of. And there have been studies of Boston in the 18th century, and they found out that molasses was a key part of the diet of many of the poorer people in Boston. Some people thought that molasses was a key factor in the American Revolution. So why would that be? Well, it has to do with the fact that governments need money. And to get money, they tax people. People in London decided that a good way to get taxes from the New World was to put a tax on sugar and molasses. Sugar and molasses that came from the Caribbean and into the British colonies of North America. Well, there was a tax on sugar, and that was terrible. But the tax on molasses was even worse because so many people relied on molasses. And it was really harmful to the poor people in North America. They said, we can't afford these taxes. And when the government in London insisted on collecting these taxes, that was one factor that made the colonists in North America eager to rebel, to fight against the mother country. As I said, sugar only grows in the tropics. And for hundreds of years, people in Europe have been wishing that they had something that they could grow that would give them sugar, but something that would grow in Europe, where it's not as warm as it is in the tropics. And around in the 1750s, a chemist in Germany figured out that if he took some beets, beets like we eat vegetables, and slice them up and squeeze the juice out of them, that juice would be sweet. Around 1800, when England was fighting with France, and France could not get sugar from the Caribbean, the French government put a lot of money into supporting French scientists and factory owners and French farmers to grow and process sugar beets so they could have a homemade source of sugar. And in time, beet sugar became a big industry in Europe, and it finally came to America. And in fact, much of the sugar that we see on our grocery shelves is beet sugar and not cane sugar, though chemically they're the same thing. Sugar beets grow in temperate climates. They grow across the whole northwest of the United States. They grow across Europe. And so we aren't dependent on tropical countries for this. 1878, there was a chemistry laboratory at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. And there was a German sugar chemist who was in Baltimore for another purpose, and he was hanging out at this Johns Hopkins University laboratory. And they were experimenting with different chemicals. And this German, his name was Fallberg, accidentally one day picked up his sandwich for lunch, tasted it, and realized that it was very sweet, sweeter than it should have been. So he looked around to see what might have gotten onto his hands, that got onto his sandwich, and he found a chemical that they were working with. And he said, "My goodness, I can make an artificial sweetener out of this stuff." And it took him about 15 years to work all the details. But eventually, by the late 1880s, he was marketing saccharin. And that is the same stuff that we still can see in the pink packets today. And the blue packet is another artificial chemical, which has a very similar story. A chemist working on some other project accidentally tastes whatever he's working with was very sweet. Now that's probably a dangerous thing to do, to test. It could have been poison. You don't want to test everything in your chemistry bench. But in these cases, it turned out to be an okay thing to do.
Now, why did you choose to study this topic out of anything else that you could have been looking at?
As I said, I look after the scientific instrument collection here in the museum. And one day I was working on some of our instruments that are called saccharimeters. These are optical instruments, pretty sophisticated instruments, that were designed and used for testing the quality of sugar. And the more I looked into the history of these instruments, I realized that it was a really wonderful story having to do with science and technology and government and food fights of all sorts, and that the whole story had not been told as well as I thought it could be. If you look at almost any can or bottle of food in your kitchen today, you will see that it contains either corn syrup or high fructose corn syrup. Now, it turns out some vegetables, like sugarcane and sugar beets, give us sucrose, which is standard sugar. I know this is technical, but bear with me on this. Other vegetables produce a sweet stuff that's called glucose. And glucose isn't as sweet as sucrose, but it's sweet nonetheless. And one of those vegetables that gives us glucose is corn. And corn, as you may know, there's a lot of it in the United States. Corn grows readily here, and it's really cheap. So for about 150 years, Americans have been squeezing the corn and getting glucose, getting corn sugar out of it. And we're using it to sweeten drinks and candies. But as I said, glucose isn't as sweet as... There's still another kind of sugar called fructose, and it comes from some fruits, and it's even sweeter than sucrose, than ordinary sugar. And in the 1950s, some smart chemists figured out how to take glucose, the stuff we get from corn and other vegetables, and flip it, turn it into fructose, so they could make what they called high fructose corn syrup. Now, this was really cheap. It was really cheap compared with ordinary sugar. And so it was very tempting for food manufacturers and soda manufacturers to use this stuff instead of sucrose, which was increasingly expensive. So if you look on the bottle of ketchup in your refrigerator, you will see that one of the key ingredients in it is high fructose corn syrup. And that means a syrup or a sugar made from corn that has been worked on in the chemical laboratory. I know that when high fructose corn syrup first came out, the big soda companies like Pepsi and Coca-Cola said, we're not going to use that. We're only going to use sugar, real sugar, because that's what we are. That's mm-hmm. what we're made of. And they couldn't compete with other companies that were using high fructose corn syrup. So they said, okay, we'll put 10% high fructose corn syrup. And the next year they said, well, we'll put 25% in. And now, I mean, for many years, it's been 100% high fructose corn syrup.
I'd like to thank Debbie Warner for taking the time to discuss the role of sugar and sweeteners in American history with us. For the History Explorer podcast series, this is Matt Ringelstetter. Join us again next month as we take another look behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. Podcast made possible with a grant from the Verizon Foundation.